This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani struck a defiant tone Monday as the U.S. reimposed sanctions over what it calls Tehran's malign behavior. In a televised address, the Iranian leader rejected an offer by President Donald Trump of unconditional talks, saying it's the U.S. that has turned its back on negotiations. He said Iran is ready for talks if there is honesty in the process. The target, Iran's purchase of dollars, metals trading, coal, the auto sector and industrial-related software. Sanctions are also scheduled in November that will intend to block Tehran's oil sales. The European Union Monday said it will move to protect European business interests in Iran. Mina Andreeva is a European Commission spokesperson.
The blocking statute, once it enters into force at 6 a.m. Our time this morning, will allow EU operators to recover damages arising from U.S. extraterritorial sanctions from the persons causing them, and nullifies the effect in the EU of any foreign court rulings based on them. It also forbids EU persons from complying with those sanctions.
The threat of sanctions has already hurt the Iranian economy, with the currency falling about 50% since April. Zimbabwe's main opposition, Movement for Democratic Change, will make public Tuesday its decision whether to challenge the result of last week's election won by the ruling ZANU-PF party. The MDC alleges security forces carried out raids in homes of opposition supporters. More than two dozen have been arrested, at least six people killed last week by troops following post-election protests. Health workers in Democratic Republic of Congo, armed with thousands of vaccines, are being deployed to the country's east to confront a new outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus. There are 43 suspected cases, a death toll reportedly above 30. This is VOA News. Canada is refusing to back down from its criticism of alleged rights abuses in Saudi Arabia. Riyadh retaliated by cutting off new trade and investment and expelling the Canadian ambassador. Chrystia Freeland is Canada's foreign affairs minister.
Our values-based foreign policy, our support for human rights and for women's rights, is an essential part of who we are when we speak for Canada in the world.
Canada Friday expressed concern over the arrest of activists, including prominent women's rights campaigner Samar Badawi. Hilal Kashan is a political science professor at American University in Beirut.
I think the decision to expel the ambassador and declare him a persona non grata was made impulsively. And if anything, it attests to the pressure that the Saudi political system is confronting these days in the midst of transition.
The row comes as Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman seeks reform to society, including allowing women to drive. Pro-government supporters rallied Monday in the Venezuelan capital Caracas in solidarity with President Nicolas Maduro following an incident the government insists was an assassination attempt using explosive-laden drones. Among those protesting in favor of the government, Alicia Sucre, who said the people are showing their affection for Mr. Maduro. The Venezuelan leader has blamed neighboring Colombia and the U.S. for being behind the assassination, a charge both governments have denied. At least six people have been detained. Gun violence in the Midwest city of Chicago over the weekend left at least 11 dead and dozens wounded. Police are blaming gang violence. Eddie Johnson is the police superintendent in America's third biggest city.
These shootings are not random. They are fueled by gang conflicts. We know who they are, and we continue to send a message that it's okay to commit these crimes by not doing anything as a community. We are all supposed to be on the same side. CPD can be better, but this city can be better.
Chicago ended last year with 650 murders, down from more than 770 in 2016. Excessive heat and drought continue plaguing much of Europe. Switzerland is cutting import tariffs on livestock feed and offering interest-free loans to help farmers cope with drought. Temperatures approach 40 degrees Celsius again in southern France. Monday, authorities on the Iberian Peninsula continued battling fires. In Bangladesh, students protested in the streets for a ninth day Monday over traffic safety after two students were killed by speeding buses. Police used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse demonstrators, dozens injured. Oscar-winning actor Robert Redford's calling it quits after the release later this year of the film The Old Man and the Gun. The 81-year-old Redford said he's retiring. He's best known for his role in the movies Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and Out of Africa. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe president gives cold shoulders to the idea of a coalition government.
I am saying the politics should now take the back seat because the elections are behind us. We should now put our shoulders to the wheel for purposes of modernizing our economy, growing our economy together.
Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, Sierra Leone's new anti-corruption chief, promises to recover all stolen public funds. Cameroon's second largest employer is losing workers due to separatist conflict. And why is Zambia preventing Congolese opposition leader Moise Katumbi from crossing its border into DRC?
The fact that the Zambian government entertained this kind of instruction from the Congolese government, the Zambian government is now like in complicity with the Congolese government to abuse the rights of Moise Katumbi.
Peter Sinkamba is the leader of Zambia's opposition Green Party. Two South Sudan analysts are optimistic Sunday's peace deal will bring some semblance of tranquility. And vanilla vigilante farmers in Madagascar take matters into their own hands. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has ruled out forming a coalition government despite his narrow win in last week's presidential election. Meanwhile, the opposition is gearing up to challenge the official results in court. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
In a television broadcast, Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa ruled out forming a coalition government with Nelson Chamisa of the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance. The two locked horns in the July 30th presidential election, with Mnangagwa winning a slim victory with 50.8% of the vote, according to official results. Asked by Sky Television whether he would form a coalition government given his narrow victory, the 75-year-old politician pointed out that his ZANU-PF party won firm control of parliament.
In 1964, Harold Wilson of Britain had one seat, beating the Conservative by one seat, and they formed government and ruled England. And I have two-thirds majority, and they are talking about me abandoning my two-thirds majority to seek a government of national unity. Not that it's a bad idea, but it doesn't show that there's any need. I am saying the politics should now take the back seat because the elections are behind us. We should now put our shoulders to the wheel for purposes of modernizing our economy, growing our economy together. Those who voted against me, those who voted for me, we say Zimbabwe is ours together. Let's move on. The best argument, the best vision, the best ideas have taken the day.
Opposition leader Nelson Chamisa has refused to accept the results given by the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission and accused it of rigging the July 30th polls for ZANU-PF party. Last week, the opposition protested in Harare. Police used tear gas and live fire to disperse the crowd, killing six people. The co-director of an international observer mission to Zimbabwe's elections, Larry Gepa, called on all parties to refrain from violence.
So we've expressed concerns about the use of excessive force. We think that's inappropriate, and we appreciated the commitment by the president to an independent investigation of the events of last week. We think it's important that there be, you know, accountability for those who are responsible for perhaps using excessive force.
On Monday, Chamisa spokesman Nkululeko Sibanda said the opposition had put together a strong legal team and will approach the court Tuesday to challenge election results. Meanwhile, some protesters who were arrested last week appeared in court Monday. The 27 protesters have been charged with public violence and malicious damage to ZANU-PF property. Attorneys from the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights say the charges should be dropped, arguing the defendants were nowhere near the scene of the alleged crimes. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The leader of Zambia's opposition Green Party has called on the Southern African Development Community, SADC, to show leadership by putting pressure on the Democratic Republic of Congo government to allow politician Moise Katumbi to return home. Peter Sinkamba also says the Zambian government blundered when it prevented Katumbi from crossing the border into DRC. Katumbi, a former governor of Katanga province and leader of the opposition People's Party for Reconstruction and Democracy, was prevented last week from entering the DRC. The official deadline for candidates to register for the December 23rd election is tomorrow, August 8th. VOA's Peter Clotty reached opposition Green Party leader Sinkamba in Zambia's Copper Belt region.
Moise Katumbi tried on two occasions from Copper Belt here to try and enter from Kasumbalesa to go into Congo, and they decided to block him. I understand that the Congolese government instructed the Zambian government not to allow him to enter in that country. Now, he is not a citizen of Zambia. He is a citizen of Congo, and he has a right to enter Congo. The fact that the Zambian government entertained that kind of instruction from the Congolese government to block their citizens from entering Congo, I think that is an abuse of the rights. In fact, the Zambian government is now like in complicity with the Congolese government to abuse the rights of Moise Katumbi. And that's why we've written to the SADC head to intervene.
Do you think SADC will adhere to your call, particularly when this is an internal matter? Some argue that you cannot intervene in the internal political situation in a member country.
As you may be aware, that the AU, the UN, and also SADC, we have various protocols. In SADC, we have the protocol on politics, defense, and security, of which Congo is a signatory. And that protocol actually provides that when there is a breach of law and order in a particular state, when the democratic processes are being compromised in a particular state, SADC has the powers to intervene to try and deal with that situation in a member state. It's not the first time, for example, that one of the RECs has intervened. We had a situation where in Congo itself, there was a Nyamulenge group which was nearly overrunning Kinshasa. And the Mandela ordered SADC troops to move in to defend the late Kabila, the father to Joseph.
Why blame the Zambian government when it is following a request by a neighbor country that it has strong relations with?
I am blaming the Zambian government on two grounds. Number one, Moise Katumbi is a citizen of Congo. And as a citizen of Congo, he has a right to go to his country of birth or his country of origin. In this particular instance, Moses has said, I want to go back to my country. And therefore, the Zambian government has no right whatsoever to block him from going back to his own country of origin, of his country of birth. If the Congolese government has issues with him, where, for example, they have been telling the whole world that Moses Katumbi is on self-exile in Europe, this is an opportunity that he wants to go back to his country, and if they have issues with him, let them go and arrest him in Congo and take him to prison if they have the due process there which has been undertaken to deal with him. But to block him to enter his country, there is no international law like that. The only international law which you would have existed is where you're not a citizen of a particular country, and the country where you want to go in says you don't want this person. Yes, that should be the case. But for a citizen, you can't block him because you now make him stateless. You cannot make someone stateless at all. He's not a citizen of Zambia, so you cannot block him and say stay in Zambia. He's a Congolese person, so let him go in Congo and then deal with him in Congo itself. Don't punish him from the Zambian soil. That is not correct.
Peter Sinkamba is the leader of Zambia's opposition Green Party. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the country's Copper Belt region. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 7th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Sierra Leone's new anti-corruption chief is promising to recover all stolen public funds. Francis Ben Kaifala, appointed last month, says his commission has the blessing of President Julius Maada Bio and that no one except a sitting president is beyond the reach of his commission. He said corruption in Sierra Leone under former President Ernest Bai Koroma was endemic. Now, Kaifala said President Maada Bio has empowered the Anti-Corruption Commission to take no prisoners in the fight against graft.
We are trying to recover monies, whether it is those who engage in business, because there's a lot of public-private partnership that the government engages in, and sometimes the business people try to use the opportunity to avoid government getting the revenue it ought to get from such a partnership, and therefore we are going after them to see how we can recover from them as much as possible. But our principal work is public officials who defraud the government, who engage in misappropriation of public resources and other corrupt practices.
In other countries, anti-corruption commissions don't have that much power. What sort of powers have you been given?
Our Anti-Corruption Act in Sierra Leone is rated by Transparency International as very strong, and it gives the commission and the commissioner powers that include other policing powers. For example, we have mandate to investigate all corruption and corrupt practices in Sierra Leone, whether it has been reported to us or otherwise comes to our attention. Nobody is basically immune for such an investigation. The only person we cannot prosecute is the president, the sitting president, while he's serving as president. We have powers to arrest without warrant. We have powers to do a lot of things, including enter business premises. I, as commissioner, can sign search warrants and carry out arrests and search premises as long as they are business premises.
So you have powers to arrest almost anyone except the sitting president. What about the former president, Ernest Bai Koroma? There were some reports some time back of allegations of some corruption deals. Is your commission looking into that?
The government has done a report called the Government Transition Report, and that report has several instances of allegations of corruption against officials of the previous government, and that includes the previous president. But there is a commission of inquiry that is being set up to look into the transition report itself. So whilst we have powers to investigate corruption, as far as that report is concerned, the Commission of Inquiry is going to look into it. And then they will refer to us where they think that it involves grand corruption.
Based on what you have seen so far by your commission, what was the level of corruption in Sierra Leone?
If you just look at the government transition report, which was released a few weeks ago, you can see that corruption was pretty endemic. The soul of this country was about to be lost to corruption. And it's as if there was no law and order. It was like a jungle where everybody was grabbing what they can and walk away with it. And it is good that we have a president who is now committed to reversing this kind of situation. He is doing his best to make sure that the fight against corruption is serious and to try to put ourselves on a trajectory of change so that we can reduce the reputational cost of corruption. Corruption is costing us so much, particularly our reputation in the international world is damaged. Just in 2013, most people responded when asked by Transparency International whether they had bribed. We were rated the most corrupt country in the world by that index because 80-something percent of the citizens admitted to have given a bribe within that specific period.
Chairman Kaifala, thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you on Daybreak Africa.
All right. Anytime. You have a nice day.
Francis Ben Kaifala is the new head of Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission. You're speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. Cameroon's second largest employer, the Cameroon Development Corporation, says it may be forced to downsize because thousands of workers have fled fighting between security forces and separatists who are seeking an independent English-speaking state. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the southwest town of Boya.
The atmosphere is quiet at the workers' residential area of the Cameroon Development Corporation in Ilioni, a village of about 5,000 people. But it's not a holiday in Ilioni. Many workers at the CDC, a state-run agro-industrial company in the English-speaking Southwest, have simply fled. Armed separatists seeking an independent English-speaking state in April killed a Cameroonian soldier in the area. The attack touched off sporadic clashes that have since led thousands of villagers to flee the area, including more than 2,000 of the CDC's 20,000 workers. 54-year-old William Kange, a father of three, says he abandoned his job and fled the area because of the ongoing clashes.
The secessionist guys attacked in broad daylight. There were bullets flying everywhere, flying over my house. People got shot, civilians most especially. Many people have gone away from their communities, and so their farms have been abandoned.
The separatists seeking to establish an English-speaking republic within Cameroon consider the state-run CDC a legitimate target. The company's vehicles, tractors, buildings, and warehouses have been torched and some of their staff kidnapped. Despite the ongoing violence, some locals have refused to run away. 57-year-old CDC nurse Suzanne Nenda says they have received threats from separatists to stop working and leave the area, but she rejects leaving the village of her birth.
If death comes, then it is God's making that I have to die. People are not living in their houses. Most of them are in the bushes. Some of the houses are burnt. Some of the villages are burnt. People don't have places to stay, so they decide to stay in the bush. They build huts in the bush and stay there.
The CDC runs banana, palm oil, and rubber plantations in Cameroon's troubled southwest. But CDC Director General Franklin Jia says only one of its 11 estates is functioning normally.
Most of our units, estates, oil mills, factories are shut down completely, while some are operating timidly. It is the only Dibuncha Palms estate that is operating relatively normally, but amidst threats. Since the 1st of July 2018, the banana sector has been hit. The packhouse was attacked and set ablaze. Till today, no work is going on.
Nje says their gross revenue has dropped by 75%, and if the attacks continue, they may be forced to lay off as many as 5,000 workers. The unrest in Cameroon began in November 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers protested being forced to use French in schools and courts and called for greater autonomy. The government crackdown that followed only encouraged separatists to take up arms. Authorities say at least 300 people, including soldiers and police, have been killed in the fighting since. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Boya, southwestern Cameroon.
Some South Sudanese analysts say they are optimistic the power-sharing deal signed on Sunday between the government and the South Sudan Opposition Alliance will enable South Sudanese citizens to realize some level of peace and tranquility in their lives without fear of violence. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
University of Juba political science professor James Okuk says getting all parties to sign the governance agreement with some issues to be dealt with later shows that Sudan also wants to see lasting peace in South Sudan.
The positive thing I see in this agreement is that people are tired of war and the leaders have no exit except to toe the line of peace. And Sudan has taken it personally that it is time for peace to come to South Sudan because the economy of the Sudan is getting into trouble. So it's no longer a joke to Sudan anymore.
Okuk says apart from giving certain South Sudanese politicians positions of power in government, the deal also spells out protections for ordinary South Sudanese who need a peaceful environment to take care of themselves and their families.
Politicians now, they are given so many seats in the parliament and in the council of ministers and in the presidency, and they are happy. And the people of South Sudan, they want an environment where they can go about the normal duties every day. And that's why they are happy and jubilant yesterday, because they are not part of the power sharing, but what they know that a peaceful environment will be created.
Abraham Awalich, a senior policy analyst at the Juba-based Sud Institute, says President Kiir's willingness to work with his main rival, Riek Machar, has given hope to the people that a genuine peace is coming to South Sudan.
The parties are willing to work toward one another, and President Kiir in particular, in the last 2 years he has been saying that he doesn't want to see Riek Machar or work with him. But now he said he wants to work with him, and I think Riek Machar also has a similar commitment.
But Awalich, certain governance issues have yet to be resolved.
As far as the bad governance is concerned, we still have a lot of work to do, which is why I believe even after this agreement, you still have to have an internal dialogue process in the country to bring on board the voices of ordinary citizens who believe that the government itself needs serious reforms.
Awalej says South Sudan should have a central governance system that is not run by a few political elites, but rather gives citizens some power in overseeing the functions of state and local government. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
The island nation of Madagascar on the east coast of southern Africa produces half of the world's natural vanilla. But as this year's season for the valuable crop begins, theft and even murder are becoming rampant. Some farmers say they aren't going to take it anymore and have formed vigilante groups to watch over their crops. Viewers Mariam Diallo reports.
At about $530 a kilo, vanilla is one of the world's most valuable natural flavorings, a crop that some would steal or even kill to get their hands on.
The vanilla thieves cut off the vanilla plants and the pods. They cut vines and put them in bags. So I've become more vigilant. This year, I bought a spear and a small pistol gun to protect myself and my farm.
Madagascar vanilla farmer João Nascena says he's not taking any chances after losing last year's harvest to thieves.
I decided to live and sleep here so that I can guard the farm.
He's not the only farmer to take drastic measures. There's been a wave of killings as growers murder those they suspect of stealing their lucrative crop. Since then, local authorities have stepped up security efforts to help protect the farms. Sernat Besoa is the local police chief.
We have been working together to try and come up with the necessary measures to curb the theft of vanilla.
Used to flavor everything from ice cream to coffee, the price of vanilla has risen exponentially since 2010 when it was only $20 a kilo. The crime wave began last year when the price of black non-split Madagascar vanilla shot up to a record $635 a kilo.
They need to stabilize the price of vanilla or reduce the price of vanilla, which we can admit is too high for the buyers. But it should be done gradually so it doesn't have a negative impact on the producers.
The higher prices have prompted some customers to switch to cheaper synthetic vanilla. And buyers say the quality of vanilla exports from Madagascar has fallen recently because some farmers, fearing the worst, may be harvesting their crops too early in the season. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has ruled out forming a coalition government despite his narrow win in last week's presidential election. Meanwhile, the opposition is gearing up to challenge the official results in court. The leader of Zambia's opposition Green Party has called on the Southern African Development Community, SADC, to show leadership by putting pressure on the Democratic Republic of Congo government to allow politician Moise Katumbi to return home. Peter Sinkamba also says the Zambian government blundered when it prevented Katumbi from crossing the border into the DRC. Katumbi, a former governor of Katanga province and leader of the opposition People's Party for Reconstruction and Democracy, was prevented last week from entering the DRC. And that's it for this Tuesday, August 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a productive day.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.